Our final study is chapters 23 to 27, which I have entitled Year-Round Commitment. All year round, the people of Israel were kept on their toes, and I guess we would do well to learn from that. Now, we'll have to move fairly briskly here. Chapter 23 concerns the annual festivals. I've heard some preachers preach marvellous sermons on some of these festivals, these annual feasts of the Lord, as they call them, and they find very deep hidden meanings in them. Well, I don't intend to do that, because the Bible doesn't encourage us to do that. And where the Bible does make an application of one of these issues, it is very clear, for example, in applying the teaching of the Passover in relation to Christ our Passover sacrificed for us. Well, the teaching is very clear. If the New Testament makes an application, well, by all means, take notice of it. But we gain nothing by just letting our imagination go wild on these things and inventing fanciful things for ourselves. I think it's much more fruitful to see what they must have meant to the people originally and try to see how this was part of their life. Now, the festivals make a lot of sense when you see them in relation to the annual cycle of events. They're all tied in with the agricultural year. The people were farmers, and the festivals are tied in with their farming activities. For example, it begins with the festival of Passover. Now, Passover itself has to do with the escape from Egypt. But tied in with that are offerings from the farm produce. We'll look at chapter 23 and we'll work it out as we go along. I should just mention, first of all, that there were two years, two calendars that operated in Israel. We might say the religious calendar, which is what we're concerned with here, and the secular calendar, which was 6 months out. That developed later on. So there's a secular calendar and a religious calendar. Well, the religious calendar is what this is about. And the festivals are grouped around the beginning of the first half of the year and around the beginning of the second half of the year. And it's very easy to remember how they all fit in through that simple observation. The beginning of the first 6 months, the beginning of the second 6 months. At the beginning of the first 6 months, we have the Passover on the 14th day of the first month to commemorate the people's miraculous escape from Egypt. And tied in with the Passover was the Feast of Unleavened Bread, because when they escaped from Egypt, they had no time to bake their bread leavened. They had to cook it as they went. And so they commemorated that in a week-long Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, at this time, the barley was just starting to ripen. And so they took a sheaf of the first bits of ripened barley, just one sheaf, went out in the field and picked a few stalks and made one sheaf and offered this to the Lord in gratitude for the harvest that they were about to reap. Now, you get the lesson from this? God comes first. We just don't stuff our pockets full of all the cash we earn and say, that's mine and that's the end of it. God comes first. And even before they got the produce, they had acknowledged God as the provider of it, and so they made an offering to him in gratitude for the harvest they were about to reap. Chapter 23, verse 5. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, in the evening is the Lord's Passover, and on the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and it lasts 7 days. Going down to going down to verse 15, we find then that 7 weeks later, that is 7 weeks after Passover, you shall count from the morrow after the Sabbath, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, that's what I just referred to, 7 full weeks. So that's 1 day plus 7 weeks, which of course equals 50 days all told. Oh, it says so in verse 16, 50 days. And then on verse 17, when that 50 days has passed, they bring another offering, this time consisting of 2 loaves of bread made from the grain which they have just harvested. Now, can you see how this fits into their agricultural activity? First of all, there was the barley sheaf at the very beginning of the harvest. And then they had the festival for a week. Now, nothing happens for the next 6 weeks. They all go back to their fields, and for 6 weeks they're working like mad, bringing in the harvest, firstly the barley, and then the wheat, which ripened behind the barley. So for 6 weeks, everybody and his dog, they're all out in the field working. And at the end of the 6 weeks, they brought in the harvest. And now they gather together again for another festival, this time to thank God for the harvest that has been reaped. So they acknowledge God at the beginning when they're starting, and they acknowledge God at the end when they've finished. At the beginning, one sheaf of grain. At the end, two loaves of bread baked with the grain. Because it was 50 days later, they called it Pentecost. In fact, this second festival I'm talking about goes under a number of names in the Bible. It's called Pentecost because, as you know, penta means five, pentagon, pentathlon, pentateuch, five. Pentecost means 50, 50 days after Passover, so it's called the Feast of Pentecost. It was also called the Feast of Harvest for the obvious reason that it was the feast at the end of the harvest. It was also called the Feast of First Fruits because the first fruits of the harvest were presented to God in the form of the two loaves of bread. And it was also called the Feast of Weeks because it was a week of weeks after the Passover, 7 times 7 plus 1. So I just mentioned that because you're going to read of it under various names as you go through the Bible. Now that is the beginning of the first half of the year. And then they all go back to their farms and they do all the things that farmers have to do with the wheat after it's been harvested. They have to grind it, they make their flour, have to sell it, take it to the markets, do all those sorts of things. But then there are other products, there are other crops, and there are all the fruit trees, and there's all the dates and the figs and the raisins and all that type of thing, vineyards and so forth. And so they go on right through the summer, and then they get to the end of the summer when all the fruits have been gathered in. Which brings us then to our second lot of festivals, which begin at the beginning of the seventh month, the beginning of the second half of the year. It starts off in verse 24 with a ceremonial blowing of trumpets on the first day of the seventh month. And this ceremonial blowing of the trumpets is to prepare the people for the Day of Atonement, which comes on the 10th day of the month, verse 27. Now, the Day of Atonement on the 10th day of the month is what we saw previously in chapter 16, the great annual day when the people brought their sins to God for atonement. And following that, in verse 34, on the 15th day of the seventh month, was the Feast of Booths, or Feast of Tabernacles, or Feast of Shelters, or Feast of Ingatherings. Don't confuse the word tabernacle here with the tabernacle tent of meeting. It wasn't that at all. The word tabernacle simply means tent. And on this occasion, the Feast of Tabernacles is not concerned with the tabernacle central place of worship. It's concerned rather with the tents, the temporary shelters, the booths, that the people lived in during their time in the wilderness. And so every year from there on, after they got into Canaan, just as they commemorated their escape from Egypt in the Passover, so they commemorated their 40 years in the wilderness camping in tents all that time. They commemorated that by this annual Feast of Shelters, and they made little shelters out of bits of palm tree and other things, and they went and lived in those for 7 days, and they had an enormous feast at the end of it. Well, in fact, right through they had a great feast. It was quite a beano, this one. So that's the Feast of Tabernacles. But also, in verse 39, we are told that it was the Feast of Ingatherings. Because on this very same day, when they had gathered in the produce of the land, they had this feast to the Lord to celebrate it, once again thanking God for the produce which he had given them. Well, now they're well stocked up, all their barns are full, they've reaped the ground, they've got their grain, they've got their fruits, and the winter now comes, and of course there's not much farming activity goes on. But then the winter passes and the rains come, there's the former rains which help to break up the ground, and they start ploughing again, and then they get their seeds sown. And then there's the latter rain which brings the seed through, starts to germinate, starts to grow, and so it grows up. You come then to the spring and the beginning of the barley harvest, and you're into the next year, and the cycle starts all over again. But you can see how the whole of these people's lives was integrated with the worship and acknowledgement of God. It's a beautiful picture here of the simple farming community of Israelites, but how God was part of the work, part of their everyday lives. It wasn't separated so much as we have. We all sort of work here, then we come to church and do our thing and go home and forget church, and we do our private things in our private lives. But here you find the whole thing was integrated, which is, I believe, the way it should be with us. We shouldn't separate things quite so sharply as we do. All right, there it is. The festivals of Israel. Moving on to chapter 24, there's a brief story there that I'll just touch on. There was a case of deliberate rebellion. A person in verse 11 blasphemed the name, the holy name which the Israelites feared even to speak. Someone blasphemed. Not just a fit of bad language, where you kick your toe or hit your thumb with a hammer or something like that. It wasn't that type of situation. It was a deliberate rebellion against God. And so they brought this chap to Moses. And in verse 12, Moses put him in custody till the will of the Lord should be declared. A very sensible thing to do, wasn't it? Sometimes we're very rash in announcing judgments. We make our decisions too hastily at times, particularly in matters of what I would call ecclesiastical discipline. Well, here you find a similar case of ecclesiastical discipline. And they waited till the will of the Lord should be known. Well, in this case, we find that the person had to be put to death because that was the penalty laid down. Verse 14, bring out of the camp him who cursed, and let all who heard him lay their hands on his head, and let all the congregation stone him. There are two points of justice that come out of this story that I can't help but mention. And there's the first one in verse 14. It's a consistent feature of the law of Moses that when a person made an accusation, and it was a capital offence, the person who made the accusation had to throw the first stone. You accuse a person of adultery or murder, the person who laid the accusation had to throw the first stone. And that reminds me of how carefree at times we are. I think if we had that sort of imposition placed upon us, we'd be much less hasty in making our accusations. It's very easy for us to throw accusations around and accuse people and say, oh yes, he did this and he did that, and we get the gossip going in no time. But here, a person had to stand up and be counted. Ah, so it was Bill Bloggs who dobbed this chap in. You see, he stood out there in front of everybody. They all knew who'd put him in. None of this sneaking behind, don't tell anybody I told you. You know the sort of thing we do? You had to come out and stand up and be counted. But more than that, you actually had to throw the first stone. Now, if we had to do that, I think we'd be a lot more careful in the accusations we make. And if I thought this person had been guilty of adultery or whatever it was, it wasn't just a case of a slur. I would have to be 100% sure before I made the accusation, because I've got to pick up a brick and I've got to stand and I've got to lob it right into his face and start smashing him up. And if I've got to do that, I'm going to be very, very careful that I know my facts before I start making accusations. Sometimes we think the Christian ethic is a bit higher than the Jews. Well, I think the Jews have got a few things going for them at times that made them be careful of what they said. That's the first point. The second point of justice I've already touched on in the previous study in verse 19, where the punishment is to fit the crime. And there it mentions an eye for an eye, a fracture for a fracture, a bruise for a bruise, cut for a cut. Whatever the offence was, you had a penalty that was appropriate. No excessive punishment for minor crimes. That's what happens in ancient societies, I'm afraid. Excessive punishment for minor crimes, and sometimes very light punishments for major crimes, particularly if it happened to be a person who was upper crust, who'd committed a major crime, and he gets off with a rap over the knuckles, a very minor punishment for a major crime. But a poor person commits a fairly minor offence against some big wheel around town, and the next thing you know, he's locked up or something for 7 years. It's a major punishment for a very minor offence, because he happens to have committed the offence against some important person in the government. No justice. And so what Moses is saying here is the punishment must be just, with no favouring the poor or the wealthy, and always in proportion. Not excessive, and not so light that it's laughable. Moving on now to chapter 25. Chapter 25 concerns the sabbatical and jubilee years. We all know that men and beasts were to be given 1 day's rest in seven. We are now told that the land is to get 1 year's rest in seven, verse 4. The seventh year shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath of the Lord. There seem to be two reasons for this. One, to enable the land to replenish its powers of reproduction, lying fallow for a year. Secondly, to remind people that God was the owner of the land. And that's the very important point that comes out in verses 6 and 7. The Sabbath of the land shall provide food for you, for yourselves, for your male and your female slaves, your hired servant and the sojourner who lives with you, for your cattle also and for the beasts. They are in your land, that are in your land, all its yield shall be for food. In other words, God will look after them. What the ground produces of itself in that seventh year will be sufficient for the poor and the animals and those who weren't able to stack up some sort of store. If you and I are fairly well off, well, we can put stuff away for the next year. But poor people don't have that capacity, and of course animals don't have that capacity. But we can trust God that God will look after us. That's the message. After all, God owns the land. That's referred to in verse 23. The land shall not be sold in perpetuity, for the land is mine. The land is mine, says the Lord. We have to remember that too. Now, we've got a title deed to say we own this piece of land on which our houses are built. But let us remember that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. And the land is mine, says the Lord. And we only hold it on trust. We're stewards. It's God's creation. And the Israelites were told this in a very, very clear-cut form. And by recognizing God as the owner of the land, they had no fear for their provisions during this sabbatical year, that is the seventh year. God says here that he will give double the produce in the sixth year to carry them through the seventh. You multiply seven by seven, you get 49, add on one makes 50, and you come to what is called the year of Jubilee. The 50th year was the Jubilee year. And in that year, all land reverted to the original owner. Now the reason for this is that when God took the people into Canaan, he saw that there was a very just and fair division of the land among the 12 tribes, and then within each of those 12 tribes, a just division among the families of those tribes. And that was to be maintained. And if this law had been followed, it would have been maintained. It was a fair arrangement, so that my family would inherit this land and it would pass on from generation to generation. If I got poor or in need, I could sell the land and get some money. But in the year of Jubilee, all the land reverted to the original owner. Now this stopped the poor getting exploited. It helped to protect them from the rich who could buy up land and so make themselves wealthier. And of course it also prevented landowners gobbling up and gaining economic power over others. However, there was a basic fairness built into the system. If the land was to revert to the original owner, then if that person sold it, the original owner sold it to get some money, he had to reduce the price proportionately. To give you an example, supposing I own this land, and the land, let us say, is worth $1,000. Now, after 20 years, I'm in dire straits and I need some cash, so I can sell the land. But I've already used it for 20 years. So if the land's worth $1,000 and I sell it, then I have to reduce the price by 2/5. I've used it for 20 out of the 50 years, so I sell it for $600. Because at the end of those 50 years, it's going to come back to me. So in other words, if it's worth $1,000 and I have it for 50 years, well, it's worth X number of dollars per year. And so you cut it down accordingly, so that if a person buys it, let us say, after 40 years, well, he only pays 1/5 of the price, because he's only going to use it for 10 years, and then I'm going to get it back. So instead of selling it for $1,000, I sell it for only $200. You get the picture? It's very simple and very fair arrangement. Forget about inflation. In this simple agrarian economy that they had, it was almost non-existent. Again, it tells us something of the basic fairness that we should practice. And I believe as Christians we ought to practice this sort of thing, because you do get Christians who don't seem to have very high principles when it comes to some of their business dealings. And here is a reminder that even though I might, because of my position, be able to get this amount of money for a certain thing, if in my heart of hearts I know it's only worth this amount, well then I ought to do the fair thing and only sell it for that amount, even if I do have the capacity to get more for it. We must be fair and just and honest and open in all these matters. The references there are in verses 13 to 17. In this year of Jubilee, each of you shall return to his property. And if you sell to your neighbour or buy from your neighbour, you shall not wrong one another. There's the underlying principle, you shall not wrong one another. According to the number of years after the Jubilee, you shall buy from your neighbour, and according to the number of years for crops, he shall sell to you. Notice the number of years for crops, because the land is used year by year to generate income. And that's why the price is adjusted pro rata, as I've described. Verse 16, if the years are many, you shall increase the price. If the years are few, you shall diminish the price. For it is the number of the crops, the number of years worth of farming activity he can get out of the land that he is selling to you. Verse 17 again, you shall not wrong one another, for you shall fear your God. I am the Lord your God, and I'm interested in your business and the way you do transactions, says the Lord. This only applied to farming land. It did not apply to land in the city, because land in the city, we just live on this minimum piece of land and we go and work in the market or someplace like that. So we're not using our land to generate income. So in the city, it was more or less open market, much as we have. But farming land, which was used to generate income, was to be dealt with on this basis, which again is very fair when you think of it, isn't it? The fairness of this Israelite system is noteworthy. And so much of our Western law really has its roots way back in the Israelite system of justice, the fair and just distribution of things, and the laws and the penalties and the way justice was administered in general. Coming to verse 35, we have a note here concerning lending to other people. You shall not take interest, it says in verse 36. But it applies in verse 35 to the man who cannot maintain himself. If your brother becomes poor and cannot maintain himself with you, you shall maintain him. You shall maintain him. The Israelites were to look upon their nation as one big family where nobody was to be poor. If a person fell into poverty, then they were to help each other. Don't take interest from him in verse 36. In other words, don't take advantage of a person who is in dire straits. Now, he's not talking about our practice of putting our money into the bank to get interest. That's an entirely different set of circumstances. This is what I said in the previous lecture. We've got to look at the reasons why things were given and not just lift verses out, stark naked, as it were, and start applying them all around the place. What he's talking about here is not taking advantage of a person who is in need. Now, if you lived in the East where we have the most ruthless loan sharks, you'd know exactly what he's talking about. That the poor person gets himself into trouble and then he's got to borrow money. And so money is lent to him by some rich person at the rate of 10% per month. Or even though cases of 10% a week, which is pretty hefty interest if you work it out. 10% a week he's got to pay back. And the chap has no option. And so the rich ruthlessly take advantage of the poor. Now that's what he's saying here. If a person's poor, he says help him out. Don't see it as an opportunity to get some quick cash, but help him out. Don't take interest from him. Now, of course, when we put our money into the bank or the building society, that's a different matter. I mean, we're not helping out some poor bank. It's just the opposite, actually. They want to take our cash and use it to make more cash for themselves. Well, they ought to pay us something for doing that with our money. So you see, that's a different system. So see it in its context and don't lift it out and go applying it wrongly. Likewise, in verse 39, if the person becomes poor, he says, if your brother becomes poor beside you and sells himself to you, you shall not make him serve as a slave, but he shall be with you as a hired servant. Now here again, don't take advantage of a person by making him a slave. As you read on in the Old Testament, you'll find quite frequently this is what happened. A person got poor and then another person seized him as a slave and called that the payment of the debt. The law of Moses says, no, that is cruel and it is inhumane. It's treating people as if they're cattle. He says, if the man becomes poor, you cannot make him your slave. If he owes you all this cash, you still can't make him your slave. But you can take him as a hired servant. He can work it off. He can work at the rate of $50 a week for the next 10 weeks and pay off his debt. So again, you see the justice and the fairness of the whole thing. I don't know if these things turn you on, but I find them fascinating, actually. And they're so down to earth. And I think if we Christians could understand the down to earthness of these things, instead of trying to get mystical meanings out of them, I'm sure we'd be a lot better Christians, because this is very practical demonstration of what godliness is. And the law of Moses gives us lots of guidelines as to how we can put our faith into practice. Coming on to chapter 26, we have a lot about promises and warnings. I'm not going to go through chapter 26 at all. It's a fairly well-known chapter. You can read it through. It's a very lengthy chapter. And to summarise it, it says this: obedience brings blessing, and disobedience brings cursing. That's the general rule. It has a particular note concerning the sabbatical and jubilee years. And it tells the people that if they don't voluntarily rest the land every seventh year and every 50th year, then God will force them to rest the land by driving them out from it, and then the land will enjoy its Sabbaths. And that's exactly what happened. You read it later on, in fact, in one of the prophets, where going right through to the end of the book of Kings, finally the nation was destroyed, the people taken into captivity in a foreign land, and then the land had its rest because the people apparently were so greedy to make money that they never followed out this law about resting the land every seventh year. God has his ways of bringing home the message. I guess we've all done that sort of thing at times. We know we should do something for the Lord. We know we should give something to the Lord. But we've got every reason why we can't do it, because we're poor or hard up or something else, or we're busy. But in the long run, the chickens come home to roost, to use an expression. And we find that we're the losers in the long run. It's better to do things the way God wants us to do them in the first place. And that's what these people had to find out. Coming now to our final chapter, it's quite a good chapter, this chapter 27, and once again I find a lot of very instructive things in it. It concerns valuation for things vowed. It's one of those chapters that you always skip if you possibly get the opportunity. In fact, most people skip most chapters in Leviticus and Numbers, because on the surface they don't look terribly exciting. But I find chapter 27 fascinating. I'll tell you what it's all about. If people made vows, I gather that what they did was to go to the temple or the tabernacle and register them. That seems to be understood. Otherwise, how are they going to find out all the things that are talked about in this chapter? You'll find that as I look at it in a moment. A person could make a vow voluntarily. If he was thankful to God for something God had done, and he says, I vow to God that I will do this and this and this, or I vow to God that I will give him this. Apparently he must have gone to the temple to make that vow, and then it was registered, I should imagine, by the priests. And when the time came, he had to fulfill his vow. You read a lot in the Old Testament about fulfill your vows. So I gather the way it went was that I'd just been saved from some great catastrophe, and so I go to the temple, I tell the priest all about it, and I make a vow that on the 30th of this month I will give God my best stud ram. And then, having arranged an appropriate ceremony, I go along and hand it over. But supposing between now and the 30th of the month I have second thoughts about my best stud ram. Ha ha, that's where the problem arises. Well, I'm sorry folks, once you've committed yourselves, that's it. And if you try to wriggle out some other way, you're going to find out in the long run that you've got more than you bargained for, and you're going to actually cough up a lot more in the long run than you would have had to cough up if you had have done what you did said you were going to do in the first place. It's a warning against being too rash in the way we make our vows. And Christians, once again, we think we're not under the law, and we're not. But we think that because we're not under the law, it doesn't matter too much if we don't keep our vows, because, you know, we're not all legalistic and that sort of thing. And so we tend to let ourselves off the hook a bit too easily, I think. That which has gone out from your lips you shall keep and perform, says the law of Moses. And I understand that to be an abiding principle that's applicable to any person in any age. What you said you're going to do, you do. And not to do so is in effect to swear falsely. One of the Psalms talks about the man who swears to his own hurt. He swears he's going to do a thing, and then later on when he comes to do it, he finds that it's inconvenient, it's going to hurt him. But he keeps his word, even though it's going to be inconvenient to do so. Now, there may, of course, be exceptional circumstances, such as you get your head chopped off, or somebody dies, or you fall over a cliff, and obviously you can't do the thing you're going to do at the time you said you're going to do it. But if we just forget about that exceptional case, the point is we must be prepared to inconvenience ourselves in order to keep faith with what we say we're going to do for God. So the vow has to be kept. However, a person may have a very good reason for wanting to change what he said. For example, his best stud ram again. Supposing there is a very good reason for him now not to give that ram, because he only had three and two of them just got stolen last week. And the only one that's left is the one he's vowed. Now he can take that one back, and provision is made here. He can buy it back. The word is redeem, but don't get thrown by the word redeem. It simply means buy back. So the thing is valued and he buys it back, but he has to add a fine. So if it's worth $100, he can buy it back, but he has to pay another 20%, so he buys it back for $120. So actually, financially, he's worse off. But in other sense, he saved himself from the calamity that might have befallen him if he had completely lost all his stud rams. So you see what happens here? It's a case of a person vows, but then maybe he doesn't want to give it over. Or maybe he never intended in the first place. He maybe went to the priest and said, look, I'll vow something to the value of my stud ram. See, that type of thing. And so he always intended only to give cash, but he used that as a guarantee, sort of collateral or something like that. You read through here and you'll get the picture. It's fairly straightforward. I've got, how many categories here? Eight categories. I must have missed up somewhere there. I should have had seven, I suppose, to keep it in the symbolism of Leviticus, but never mind. Perhaps if I combined a couple, I could get it down to seven, and then I'd keep faith with those who'd like to find sevens all through the book. I've got eight categories anyway here in Leviticus of things that are vowed. Now the first one is a person. I can vow my son or my daughter, I offer him to the Lord. We get cases of that. Samuel's parents vowing him to the Lord. Now you couldn't sacrifice a person. Human sacrifice was forbidden in the law of Moses. But the person could be bought back. In fact, he had to be bought back because he wasn't allowed to be sacrificed on the altar. So he was valued, and then you paid the equivalent in money, and so you gain the person back. So this is not a case of having second thoughts. When the person valued, or beg your pardon, when the person vowed his son, he knew all the time that he wasn't going to hand him over to be a prisoner or to be locked up or sacrificed on the altar. He knew that that was saying, I'm giving this person, but now I'm going to buy him back at a set price. And the prices are there given in the first eight verses. I'll just summarize it for you. For a male up to 5 years of age, the price was 5 shekels. From 5 years to 20 years of age, the price was 20 shekels. From 20 to 60 years of age, the price was 50 shekels. Over 60, it dropped back to 15 shekels. And I'm sorry to tell you this, but the values for females were a bit less. That is a reflection of the era to some extent, but also the valuations, as you can see from the ones I quoted, were all based on work capacity. And remember that they were all farmers, they were outside workers, they were labourers. And so I guess that a man could turn in more work in the labouring field than could a woman. And so that would account for the variation there in the values. And likewise, a man from 20 to 60, the man in the maturity of his manhood, is obviously worth a lot more than, say, a person who's over 60. So you can see that they're valued according to their usefulness in the workforce. That's the way it's worked out in simple terms. That's the first category. Second category concerns what we call clean animals. That is, animals that were eligible for sacrifice, such as lambs, goats and cattle. They could be dedicated to God through sacrifice, an actual sacrifice on the altar, or they could be given to the priests, and the priests could then use it or sell it as he wished. If, however, after the person has vowed something, he then sneaks along and tries to get an inferior animal through and he's caught, he loses both. Back to my best stud ram illustration again. Supposing I vowed and then I have second thoughts and I see another, oh, it's not a bad ram, this one. I'm sure he'll be just as good. God will be satisfied with that. And I'll take that one along instead. But the priest happens to know that that's not really the one that I'd vow. That's about number five down the list. He's not even a junior champion, this one. He's just one of the run-of-the-mill. And he finds out, I lose both. I lose the one I've taken along, and the best stud ram also goes. So there it is. That's in verse 10. We can't cheat God, you see. That's what it's all about. He shall not substitute anything for it or exchange it, a good for a bad or a bad for a good. If he makes any exchange of a beast for a beast, then both it and that for which it is exchanged shall be holy, that it shall be given to God. Third category, unclean animals. An unclean animal would be an ass or a camel or a working animal like that that was not fit for sacrifice. Well, therefore it couldn't be sacrificed. It could be given to the priests as usual, and the priest could sell it. Or it could be redeemed, that is, the person could buy it back. Now, if he buys it back, as I mentioned before, he adds a fine of 20%. So, in effect, he loses financially, he's worse off. You notice that in verse 13. If he wishes to redeem it, he shall add a fifth of its value. The fourth category concerns houses, and pretty well the same applies. You vow the house, and then when you buy it back, the value of the house, add on 20%, and that's what you pay. Verse 16 following talks about land. Now again, I could value my land. I could vow my land. I beg your pardon. I could vow my land. But then I want to buy it back. Well, it depends on how many years to the Jubilee. Supposing it's 25 years on. And then I want to buy the land back. Well, it's worth $1,000 originally. It's only now worth $500. Because we've already had 50% of the use out of it. There's only 50% left, so the price drops proportionately. If, of course, I vow it and I never buy it back, and it goes right through to the Jubilee, well then, stiff cheese, I've lost it. It just goes straight to the sanctuary, and it becomes the property of the priests, if it was my land originally. But supposing it wasn't my land originally, supposing it was Isaac's over here, and he owned it and I bought it from him, and then later on I bought it to the Lord, and I still hadn't bought it back before the Jubilee came around. Well, when the Jubilee came around, it went back to the original owner, not back to me and not to the priests. So there again you can see the fairness of the system. If you can't remember all that, don't bother, but at least you get the idea of what's happening here. We come to the sixth category, firstlings. You know, the firstlings belong to God. The firstborn of every animal belong to God, because going back to the time of the Passover, God spared the firstborn of Israel. And from that point on, he says, all the firstborn belong to me. And so the firstborn of clean animals had to be sacrificed to God in a ritual sacrifice. The firstborn of unclean animals could not be sacrificed because they weren't eligible, so they were bought back by the sacrifice of a clean animal in its place. Human beings, of course, could not be sacrificed. They were bought back. You read about the redemption of the firstborn. So that was a standard procedure. The firstborn was always bought back. Mary, the mother of Jesus, took her child along. When she was dedicated, after the cleansing from childbirth, at the same time her child was redeemed, and she paid the ransom price for the redemption of Jesus, her firstborn. For that reason, therefore, clean firstborn could not be vowed, because they already belong to God. You can't vow to God something he already owns. And the seventh category concerned unclean firstborns, unclean firstlings, and as I said, they were bought back or sold by the priests as they wished. Coming down to the final category, the eighth category I've got here, and that is devoted things. Now, by devoted things, I mean things that belong to God. They could not be vowed, they could not be redeemed, they could not be bought back, they could not be sold. Devoted things. We use the expression devoted of a person who's very devoted to God. He loves the Lord and, you know, he's a very sincere and godly person. That's not what it's talking about here. Devoted means, of course, belonging to the Lord. But even bad things were devoted to the Lord. Bad things were holy. Now, that's very strange to us because we thought holy meant purity. Well, it does in the New Testament. Going back to the Old Testament, holy meant different. A thing was holy because it was separate from the ordinary things of life. It was different. It was given to God. Clothes were holy. Places were holy. Animals could be holy. in the sense that they were given to God. They were separated from the ordinary things of life and given over to God. Even the things in Jericho, when Joshua conquered Jericho, all the loot was holy. It was given to God so that he could destroy it. So things, devoted things or holy things, could be destroyed. You see what it means? It means they are separate from ordinary life, they are given over to God, and then he can do what he likes with them. The good things he's pleased with, the bad things he destroys. And in warfare, we find that loot was devoted to God for destruction. So no devoted thing could be vowed to God. It couldn't be redeemed, it couldn't be sold, couldn't be bought back. It had to be disposed of according to whatever the law was. That's referred to in verse 28. No devoted thing that a man devotes to the Lord, of anything that he has, whether of man or beast, or of his inherited field, shall be sold or redeemed. Every devoted thing is most holy to the Lord. No one devoted who is to be utterly destroyed from among men shall be ransomed. He shall be put to death. So there's even a bad person under sentence of death. He's called holy, devoted to the Lord. You can't buy him back. He has to bear the punishment. Well, that's the end of those categories. Just to finish, the last few verses concerns tithes. And once again, we know that tithes had to be paid by the people. One-tenth of all the produce, one-tenth of all the animals, one-tenth of all his income from his farm had to be given to God per annum. And the way it was worked out was very simple. And here again, you can see the honesty of it. The animals, for example, were counted as they went into the pen. He sat up there with his stick and he tapped them as they went past. And every tenth he gave a poke and pushed it off into a side pen. Every tenth one. Good or bad, all went through. You couldn't say, oh, that was a good one, come back here, I'll put a bad one through instead. If it was a bad one, okay, it went through. If it was a good one, okay, it still went through. You see the honesty again? We're very good at juggling things, aren't we? We're very cunning. But here we find that there was none of that sort of thing going on. And if you decided that you wanted to keep some of your tithe, then you could. If, for example, I'd had some sort of problem with my flocks and I didn't really want to part up with one-tenth of my flocks as the offering to the Lord, I could keep them, but I had to pay the equivalent in money plus a fifth. So in one way or other, the person still paid the tithe. But if he wanted to keep for himself what had been given to the Lord, then he was fine with his 20% fine. So in the end, again, he lost. As I say, it's much better to do the right thing in the first place. Well, there it is, verse 30. We'll read them through. All the tithe of the land, whether of the seed of the land or the fruit of the trees, is the Lord's. It's holy to the Lord. If a man wishes to redeem any of his tithe, he shall add a fifth to it. And all the tithe of herds and flocks, every tenth animal of all that pass under the herdsman's staff, shall be holy to the Lord. A man shall not inquire whether it's good or bad, neither shall he exchange it. If he exchanges it, and he gets caught, then both it and that for which it is exchanged shall be holy. And you can't redeem it either in those conditions. So there it is. God is not to be mocked, and God is not to be cheated. Well, I trust that in all of that we found something in the book of Leviticus that makes some sense to us. And we'll read that last verse. These are the commandments which the Lord commanded Moses for the people of Israel on Mount Sinai. I hope also we find that they're not only the commandments which he commanded Moses for the people of Israel on Mount Sinai, but there's also something in them which he commands us today, where we live, and that we can see the underlying principles, see the teaching, and apply it to our own lives so that we too are fitting servants of the Lord.